From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
But there is no doubt that the constant campaign and the discussions have hurt the UN. This is not something we would like, and that's why we want to get to the bottom of it and clear it as quickly as possible.
The UN oil for food scandal, part of a U.S.-led attack on the United Nations, or proof of corruption that could take the UN Secretary General down? Today, we host a debate. Then, an unusual family story.
When I was 4 years old, the FBI and the New York Police Department stormed into my family's apartment in the Bronx and arrested my family. I had no idea they were members of the Weather Underground, and I certainly didn't know that the FBI had been investigating my ancestors for over 70 years.
Even more than a month ago, this book is important. It's a book about a family's three generations of resistance to the government.
Ty and Jeff Jones, son and father, a radical line from the labor movement to the Weather Underground, one family's century of conscience. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 30 people have died so far today in a pair of major attacks carried out by the Iraqi resistance in Baghdad. Four suicide bombers drove a minibus loaded with explosives into a Shiite mosque during Friday prayers, killing themselves and 14 worshippers. Meanwhile, as many as 16 police officers died when gunmen fired mortars at an Iraqi police station. President Bush is expected to nominate former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik today to become the nation's new Homeland Security Director, replacing Tom Ridge. One presidential adviser told the Washington Post that Kerik, quote, brings 9/11 symbolism into the cabinet. Kerik was serving as police commissioner at the time of the attacks. More recently, he spent time in Iraq helping to rebuild Iraq's police force and has worked as a consultant for former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's firm, Giuliani Partners. Prior to becoming a New York police officer, Kerik spent 4 years in Saudi Arabia overseeing security for the Saudi royal family. In one of his first moves after learning of his new job, Kerik had to sell off $5 million worth of stock in Taser, the stun gun manufacturer. Kerik has no experience working in Washington. He'll oversee the massive department that includes 22 former agencies and offices. President Bush has also nominated Nebraska Governor Mike Johanns to head the Department of Agriculture. Johanns was a Democrat up until 1988. He's come under criticism for promoting conservative Christian beliefs while governor. In May 99, he signed a proclamation declaring March for Jesus Day. He later endorsed a Back to the Bible Day in honor of a fundamentalist Christian group in Nebraska. In related news, John Danforth has resigned as UN ambassador, and Tommy Thompson is expected to resign soon as Secretary of Health and Human Services. A 9-month-long BBC investigation has revealed that the city of New York has been forcing HIV-positive children under its supervision to be used as human guinea pigs in tests for experimental HIV drug trials, in some cases against their will. All the children in the program are under the legal guidance of New York's Child Welfare Department, the Administration for Children's Services. Most were living either in foster care or independent homes run on behalf of the local authorities. Almost all the children are believed to be African American or Latino. One New York social worker told the BBC she'd never been informed that the drugs she was administering to the children were experimental and highly toxic. Jacqueline Herger has said, quote, "We were told that if they were vomiting, if they lost their ability to walk, if they were having diarrhea, if they were dying, then all of this was because of their HIV infection. In fact, it was the drugs that were causing many of the problems." The BBC identified pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline as one of the companies that provided the drugs for the tests. In election news, Congressmember John Conyers and 9 other members of Congress have asked Ohio Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell to answer a series of questions about irregularities and complaints in last month's presidential elections. The Diocese of Orange County in Southern California has agreed to pay out more than $85 million to 87 victims of clergy sexual abuse, what's expected to be the largest settlement in the history of the Catholic Church. The American Civil Liberties Union has launched a nationwide effort to expose how the FBI has resumed spying on environmental, anti-war, political, and religious groups. The ACLU has filed Freedom of Information Act requests in 10 states and the District of Columbia in an effort to force the FBI to hand over files on targeted groups and individuals. The ACLU said it has evidence that the government has infiltrated student peace activists, gathered files on American Friends Service Committee anti-war events, interrogated animal rights activists in their homes, sent undercover agents to National Lawyers Guild meetings, and aggressively questioned Muslims and Arabs on the basis of religion or national origin rather than suspicion or wrongdoing. Under questioning by a federal judge, the government claimed this week that the military could hold foreigners indefinitely as enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay for aiding a terrorist organization, even if they did so unintentionally. A judge asked whether the government could detain a little old lady in Switzerland who donated money to an Afghan orphanage if, unbeknownst to her, some of the money went to Al-Qaeda. A government attorney responded, quote, she could. Someone's intention is clearly not a factor that would disable detention. Deputy Associate Attorney General Brian Boyle went on to claim the U.S. military can pick up and detain any foreigner who provides support to terrorists. And once at Guantanamo, Boyle said detainees, quote, have no constitutional rights enforceable in this court. In response, an attorney for some of the Guantanamo detainees said, quote, that's really shocking. People throughout the world will fear the United States is asserting the power to pick up little old ladies and men who made a mistake. Also at the court proceeding, the government claimed it has the right to use evidence gained by torture in deciding whether to detain people at Guantanamo. Statements produced under torture have been inadmissible in U.S. courts for about 70 years. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights has upheld Peru's jailing of Lori Berenson. The New Yorker has been held in Peru since 1995 when she was convicted by a hooded military judge of collaborating with the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. She was originally sentenced to life in jail. Later, her sentence was reduced to 20 years. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights was seen as Berenson's last avenue of appeal. She has always said she is innocent of the charges against her. In Alabama, Republican state legislator Gerald Allen has introduced a bill that would ban all novels with gay characters from public libraries, including universities. If the bill passes, Allen said books containing gay characters will have to be removed from library shelves and destroyed. One book that would have to be destroyed is Sisters, a 1981 lesbian romance novel written by Lynn Cheney, the wife of the current Vice President Dick Cheney. And 20 years ago today, the city of Bhopal in India suffered one of the worst industrial disasters in history. Tons of lethal gases leaked from Union Carbide's pesticide factory. 7,000 people lost their lives within days. 15,000 more died in the following years. 100,000 others are still suffering chronic and debilitating illnesses. For years, activists have called on Union Carbide and its parent company, Dow Chemical, to take full responsibility for the disaster and to clean up the contaminated site. And for a little while today, it appeared that Dow Chemical had done just that. A Dow spokesperson named Jude Finisterra told the BBC, quote, today I am very, very happy to announce that today, for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. This is a momentous occasion, she said. Finisterra went on to say, quote, we have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the 120,000 who may need medical care for their entire lives, and to fully and swiftly remediate the Bhopal plant site, unquote. But it turns out the interview was a hoax. No Jude Finisterra works at Dow. The company has not taken full responsibility for the disaster, and no $12 billion fund has been set up. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, Asian Dub Foundation Remix, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Juan, you wrote a very interesting piece in the New York Daily News this week about the elections in Ohio.
Yes. Well, myself and another reporter at the Daily News, Larry Kolaresis, have been looking at the returns in Ohio. Specifically, we concentrated on the Cleveland returns because one of the problems that you have in elections is that unless you get down to the precinct level and get a good sense of what was happening at the various precincts, you really can't get a clear picture of any voter problems. So we concentrated on Cleveland because it was the only city that where the Board of Elections had actually posted on their website the precinct by precinct returns. And lo and behold, we found that there were hundreds of votes that we could definitely determine appeared to have been cast mistakenly in that we found that the third party candidates in a lot of inner city black precincts in Cleveland were showing huge votes for Perutka, the Constitutional Party candidate, a fringe, very right-wing candidate, and for the Libertarian Party candidate, Michael Badnarik. In some places, in all the places, the votes were much higher than Bush had gotten, but in some cases almost reached the numbers that Kerry got. We estimated that there seemed to have been at least about 700 votes that we could determine for sure seemed to have been totally beyond the realm of possibility that many voters in one black precinct in Cleveland would have voted for a totally unknown candidate. Since then, as we've begun to look at it more, we begin to understand how it happened, that in Ohio, the various precincts, presidential candidates don't have the same position on the ballot. Every precinct, they rotate the positions on the ballot. So in those precincts where, in those polling places where you had more than one precinct, and in many inner city areas, you'll have a church that has three different precincts all voting in the same place. So what apparently might have happened is that as the lines were very long, untrained poll workers may have allowed voters to use a card a punch card to vote in the wrong precinct. As a result, they may have voted for Kerry, but inadvertently, since they were not the order of the candidates in that other polling place was in a different order, they then ended up casting a vote for Badnarik or for Perutka. So if in Cleveland alone, but the problem is we think it's actually much bigger. We think it may be in the thousands because there were two other possible erroneous votes that you could have cast, one for Bush if you were meant to vote for Kerry, or one for for Cobb, who had been actually removed from the ballot, but there was still a line there in the ballot box because he'd been removed at the last minute. So we're now trying to find out how many votes were cast in the blank ballot space. And also, people would say, well, wouldn't Bush have the same possibility of losing votes? Technically, yes. But in Cleveland, in these inner city districts where the votes were almost always 10 to 1, 11 to 1, for Kerry, it was highly unlikely that many Bush votes would have been lost. And this is just in the city of Cleveland. We suspect that this problem may have been across the state. Anywhere where you had more than one precinct in a polling place, you risk the possibility of this mix-up, which would have actually resulted in thousands of votes being lost, thousands of Kerry votes.
And now Congressmember John Conyers and nine other members of Congress are calling on the Ohio Secretary of State, Kenneth Blackwell, who was also deeply involved with the Bush-Cheney campaign, to answer a series of questions about irregularities and complaints in last month's presidential election. And tomorrow, Pacifica is having a webcast, a three-hour program out of Ohio looking at voting irregularities, and people can go to sites like WBAI.org to listen to that broadcast. Also, Juan, we will be putting your piece at democracynow.org.
And I'd like to say we are continuing to look at other problems in Ohio that clearly indicate that there are questions as to the turnout in a lot of precincts that doesn't seem to bear with the overall turnout in the state. So hopefully we'll be able to report some more on that early next week.
Well, thanks, Juan, for all of your work. As we turn now to the oil for food scandal that has been getting more attention over these last few days.
Yes, well, it's a controversy that has been brewing for months. Some say it's part of the U.S.-led attack on the integrity of the United Nations as retribution for its stance on the invasion of Iraq. Others say it shows corruption on the part of an institution that the U.S. has termed soft on dictators and an obstruction to U.S. policy. President Bush Thursday called for what he termed a full and open accounting of the UN Oil for Food Program. But he would not say whether he thought UN Secretary General Kofi Annan should resign.
Earlier this week, Republican Senator Norm Coleman of Minnesota called on Annan to resign. Coleman is investigating corruption in the now-defunct Oil for Food program. He said former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein reaped some $21 billion from the program because of Annan's lack of oversight. But Coleman's estimate is higher than some others. A State Department official was quoted by Reuters as saying the calls for Annan's resignation were, quote, premature. Here's some of what President Bush had to say on Thursday.
It's very important for the United Nations to understand that there ought to be a full and fair and open accounting of the Oil for Food program in order for the taxpayers of the United States to feel comfortable about supporting the United Nations. There has to be an open accounting, and I look forward to that process going forward.
Should he resign, sir?
We look forward to the full disclosure of the facts, good, honest appraisal of that which went on. And it's important for the integrity of the organization to have a full and open disclosure of all that took place with the Oil for Food program.
That was President Bush speaking yesterday. At issue is the $64 billion program for Iraq, administered by the United Nations and supervised by the 15-nation Security Council. For months, accusations of corruption within the program have been consistently launched at Annan and other UN officials.
In one of the more complicated twists in the story, Kofi Annan's son Kojo worked for a Swiss firm that inspected goods under the program and is under investigation. On November 29th, UN spokesperson Fred Eckert had this to say.
As to his son Kojo and the specific allegations that he continued to receive payment from Cotecna until February of this year, the Secretary General said he had been under the impression that those payments had stopped in 1998. When he recently found out they had in fact continued until this year, the Secretary General said he was surprised and disappointed. He added that his son is a grown man and that the Secretary General doesn't get involved in his son's business and that his son doesn't get involved in the UN's business. The Secretary General also asked reporters to be patient and await the conclusions of the independent Volcker panel, which is examining these issues.
UN spokesperson Fred Eckert. Representatives of the Swiss firm that inspected goods under the Oil for Food program previously said Kojo Annan had no involvement in UN contracts. On Monday, the UN confirmed he'd received payments after leaving the company in 1998 that did not end until February 2004. Here's what Kofi Annan himself had to say about his son and the Oil for Food controversy.
No, I think this is an issue that, as I've said, Volker and the committee members are dealing with it, and I hope it will be expeditious and we'll get the facts out quickly. But there is no doubt that the constant campaign and the discussions have hurt the UN. This is not something we would like, and that's why we want to get to the bottom of it and clear it as quickly as possible. It has done damage, yes.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, when we come back, a debate on the UN for Food controversy, the UN Oil for Food controversy. Back in a minute. Rahima Hajj, Dance of the Palms. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about the oil for food controversy now raging over at the United Nations, we're joined by Claudia Rosette, who's one of those who broke the story. Her latest piece is Secretary and Son. Kofi Annan isn't Kojo's keeper, but he can't shirk responsibility for the UN. We're also joined by Joy Gordon, who's written extensively about the Oil for Food program in The Nation and Harper's. Her piece, The UN Is Us, Exposing Saddam Hussein's Silent Partner. We're going to begin, though, with Claudia Rosette. Can you lay out what you see the controversy or scandal to be?
Oh, the basic scandal is that the UN began by providing what was supposed to be a relief program to feed sick and hungry people in Iraq and ended up providing cover for an enormous scam in which billions, you know, pick your estimate, but without any question, billions upon billions were grafted by Saddam Hussein and his many business partners out of the money pumped from the oil wells of Iraq that was supposed to fund this relief program. And part of the question is, to what extent was the UN oblivious and to what extent was it actually complicit? And that's really what the investigations at this point, or at least some of them, are looking into. And as far as sort of concerns the UN itself, that's the core of the problem. You know, how on earth did it happen that this is the largest amount of money grafted out of a relief program probably in history.
And the particular twist of the connection now or the taint to the Secretary General himself?
The Secretary General himself has a son, Kojo Annan, who worked for a company that was on the day that his contract lapsed with them at the end of 1998, this company, which is based in Geneva, Switzerland, was hired to inspect the relief goods arriving in Iraq under this program to authenticate that they were what they were supposed to be. And there's some question about how well that got done, according to the UN's own internal audits, one of which leaked this spring. The story gets very complicated. There are many layers to this thing. But at that point, some time back, the understanding given out by the UN was that Kojo Annan's connection with this company, which is called Kotecna, had ended. It's then turned out, sort of in successive stages, that no, Kotecna had continued to send payments to the son of the Secretary General under the label of paying him not to set up competing operations with their business in West Africa. These payments had continued until February of this year, is what we've now learned. In other words, the payments continued for 3 months longer than the full duration of Kotecna's contracts with the UN under the Oil for Food program. So we don't know at this point whether anything wrong was done in that this particular piece of the story, but what we do know, this qualifies by any lights as a conflict of interest, and it's the kind of thing where, at the very least, it should be disclosed. It's the kind of thing the public should have known about from the start.
Joy Gordon, you're a professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, completing a book on the sanctions program in Iraq. And your piece in Harper's begins, "The Bush administration was still reeling from the revelations about Abu Ghraib prison this year when supporters of the president suddenly took note of a dramatic new scandal involving Iraq. The richest ripoff in world history," wrote William Sapphire. Can you talk about your take on what's happening?
Sure. I actually think the business with Kotecna is something of a red herring. If you look at how the accusations are typically framed, it's the UN failed to do this, or how could the UN have done nothing in the face of the smuggling and kickbacks? In fact, what's crucial here is to make a distinction about the different entities with the UN. There's a difference between the Security Council and the Secretariat. And many of the policies that permitted the smuggling and kickback to take place cannot be laid at the feet of the Secretary General. They are the policies of the Security Council. And the Secretary General has no control over the Security Council. And if we look at the claim that the UN failed to catch contracts with pricing irregularities, well, again, that goes to the Security Council, whose job was to review all of these contracts. And if we look at the policies and the failures that are now being laid at the feet of the United Nations, many of them, in fact, are due not only to the Security Council, but to particular members within the Security Council. For many of these things, the policy, for example, that allowed the Iraqi government to choose who it would trade with, well, that was a Security Council resolution, 986, in combination with a Security Council-approved memorandum of understanding, and the member states, including the United States, were in support of that. If we look at the committees, if we look at the council's failure to block contracts with pricing irregularities, and it was the Security Council's responsibility, not the Oil for Food staff. They did not have the authority to block contracts, only to present information to the Security Council. Then, in fact, what we see is none of the members of the Security Council, including the United States, chose to block contracts where there were obvious price irregularities, even when UN staff presented that information with documentation to them.
We're talking to Joy Gordon, author of, among her pieces, "The UN Is Us, Exposing Saddam Hussein's Silent Partner," and Claudia Rosette, who has exposed this story in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Sun. We want to turn now to Dennis Halliday. He was in our studios about a week ago, the former assistant UN Secretary General, who's in charge of the Oil for Food program. This is what he had to say about it.
No. I think it's because the UN has become irritating. The Secretary General finally has woken up to his responsibility and has announced that the war is illegal, which has sort of threatened, I think, the United States and Britain, perhaps. and the old frustration of the neocon right wing who feels the UN is a threat, international law is unacceptable. It's part of the rejection by the Bush regime of Kyoto, of the ICC, of all the other international laws which the rest of us in the world feel are so important, but are rejected by Congress as they, because they feel it impinges on the Constitution and their function and so on.
When Charles Delfer addressed the Congressional subcommittee, he singled out a former UN official, Ben Sevan, as a recipient of some 13 million barrels of oil from Saddam Hussein. Now, Sevan has denied the charges. He was your boss in Iraq?
No, I worked directly for the Secretary General, but he became the boss of von Sponeck in a few years after my period in Baghdad.
And what do you believe? Do you believe that denials?
I believe Mr. Sevan is innocent until proven guilty. I think the point to make, however, is that we put together $64 billion from Iraqi oil sales, gross. The UN took off 35%. They gave 30% to Kuwait while Iraqi children were dying for lack of water and adequate foodstuffs. And that's a crime in itself, in my view. And many of us believe sanctions, in fact, turned out to be genocidal. But the Oil for Food program did extraordinarily good work. We fed over 20 million Iraqis every day for many years. We saved, I would think, hundreds of thousands of lives. This so-called scandal is a fiction, in my view. Now, if some members of the Secretariat broke the rules, they must be prosecuted like any other normal human being. I don't believe the Secretariat is the problem. The problem is the United Nations and its member states, particularly Washington and London, who make the decisions, who design the sanctions, who design the Gulf War and the most recent invasion. These are the people who make the decisions that impact on Iraq. They are the ones who knew what was happening. They allowed the Baghdad government to have hard currency from Jordan and Turkey and other smuggling arrangements and kickbacks. They know all about this. It's nonsense to put the finger on Kofi Annan or the Secretariat.
Do you think so? Kofi Annan should open all the documents, just make the UN transparent on
this? Absolutely. I can't understand why he's holding back information. They should open the doors, open the files. People like von Sponeck and myself and others should be made available to Volcker and to those in Washington who are concerned. I think we can show there's a different light here. This is not a complex issue. This is a known private sector quantity approved by Washington.
Former Assistant UN Secretary General Dennis Halliday, who was in charge of the Oil for Food program in Iraq. Claudia Rosette, your response.
Sure. Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, does have one thing he can do with the Security Council, and it can be a powerful thing. He can speak up. And it's true that he can't tell the member states, he can't force the member states to do something, but he has been quite outspoken on some of the things on which he's disagreed. On this program, in fact, he spoke up quite often, protesting the U.S. and U.K. putting contracts on hold. But he never got up and used his considerable public platform to say, we're seeing evidence of massive corruption going through this program. There are huge pricing irregularities. Also, the Secretariat collected $1.4 billion from Saddam's oil funds. That's a huge amount of money to basically monitor the integrity of this program. They did not use that money to sufficiently monitor the oil revenues, the amount of oil flowing out, thus the many billions that ended up becoming the illicit money that we're talking about. They did not use their $1.4 billion to really adequately look at the pricing problems. You know, whatever they presented to the Security Council, it was, as far as we can see, given the UN secrecy, which is part of the problem here, it was pretty minimal. They were not beating on drums and saying Saddam is scamming 20% out of contracts for baby formula, which appears to have been the case. They were very quietly relaying now and then odds and ends, but they really made no good faith systematic attempt to use their enormous funding to really keep track of this. So that's part of the problem. And I think it's the fact that the Secretariat had the actual budget to monitor the program, hired the inspectors. And that's where it's not a red herring that
But I'd like to ask you on that point. Joy Gordon, in one of her articles in The Nation, has noted that on at least 70 occasions, the staff of the United Nations did bring to the attention of the 661 Committee, the Security Council body that was in charge of implementing the sanctions, pricing irregularities, and yet the Security Council, the member states, which include also the United States, chose not to do anything about it. So to what degree is our own government, was our own government complicit or had a knowledge of these problems beforehand and didn't do anything about it until now?
Well, it was the least culpable of all of them. We're the only ones who actually tried to stop anything here. And the, you know, far worse were the other three. The U.S. and the U.K. were the only ones who really tried to stop anything. Far worse were the other three permanent five members, Russia, France, and China, who just never protested anything here, who wanted the program to continue and expand. But again, if you go back to the Secretariat, can you point me to a single instance where Kofi Annan, who has spoken out quite freely with his views about the U.S. approach to Iraq, you know, he's felt in recent times, he's talked about he thinks it was illegal, he finds it inconceivable, he's put his opinions quite strongly on record, inconceivable that France, Russia, or China could ever let corruption influence their votes in the Security Council. So we have him speaking up quite boldly on these scores. Can you point to a single instance where he spoke up to say this program has going on within it major problems of graft and fraud and theft, which is basically taking money meant to feed the people of Iraq, which is ending up scamming things like functional medicine out of their supplies and sending them substandard goods? Can you point to a single instance where he got up and said that?
Well, Joy Gordon, we give you the last word. Can you respond to this point and the larger one of where this story should go from here?
Sure. I do think we need to look at the U.S. role in this, and I do think we need to acknowledge how much of this information was completely known to every member of the Security Council, including the U.S. and the U.K. If you look, for example, at the smuggling, according to now the Delphi report as well as the Congressional Research Service reports, what we see is that there was no lack of information that it was going on. What we see is that every single year from 1994 on, the U.S. The U.S. administrations issued waivers saying we would not impose sanctions against Jordan and Turkey, which were collected, which were jointly engaged in over $5 billion of smuggling in the most visible public way. So it's not for lack of information. And I think, again, we just have to look, if there's a concern about information, there was not enough information made public, and by the way, there was an enormous amount of information made public. But if the objection is this piece of information should have been posted on the website in addition to the massive amount that was already there, well, we have to look at the Security Council. That was the body that said, here's what will be released publicly, here's what will be not released publicly. We have to look at the Security Council. What are the criteria for reviewing contracts? What do we require in them? That was the Security Council. What are the procedures? That was the Security Council. What the Secretariat did was simply implement the procedures established by the Security Council and, on multiple occasions, inform the Security Council when there were irregularities. In the case of the kickbacks on the import contracts, over 70 times. It was not the Secretariat's job to block contracts. They simply didn't have authority. When there were pricing irregularities, they took it exactly to the body that could act on that. If we look at the surcharges on the oil, again, it's exactly the same thing. As soon as it became apparent, UN staff, the oil overseers, went to the Security Council, said this is what's going on, and it was up to the Security Council members to act. I think that's where we need to look.
Joy Gordon, Claudia Rosette, I want to thank you both for being with us. We will certainly continue to follow this controversy. When we come back, unusual family line will speak with a son and his father about their family history. In 1981, the FBI stormed into four-year-old Ty Jones' house and took away his parents, members of the Weather Underground. He's written a book to tell his story. We'll be joined by Ty Jones and his father in a minute. Bob Dylan, Subterranean Homesick Blues, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today, an unusual family story. From the labor movement to the Weather Underground, we take a look at one family's tradition of resistance. A new book is out. It's called A Radical Line, and it's by Ty Jones. He had used multiple aliases before he reached the age of four. In 1981, FBI stormed into his home and took away his parents, fugitive leaders of the Weather Underground. First, we wanted to go back for a moment, some 35 years, to the days of the Vietnam War and a clip of this film, Weather Underground.
At 7:30 this morning, KPFK received a call from a woman identifying herself as a member of the Weather Underground.
Hello. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weathermen Underground. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Freaks are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are freaks. If you want to find us, this is where we are. In every tribe, commune, dormitory, farmhouse, barracks, and townhouse, where kids are making love, smoking dope, and loading guns, fugitives from American justice are free to go. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
And that was Jeff Jones at the end of that clip from the film Weather Underground. He joins us in the studio now today, many years later, as a dad, Jeff Jones, father of Ty Jones. Ty Jones, who's written this new book, A Radical Line, From the Labor Movement to the Weather Underground, One Family's Century of Conscience. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
It's great to be here.
Ty, why don't you begin the way you begin your book? It is a very dramatic moment. You're 4 years old.
Well, it starts on the night that my parents were arrested. We were sitting around. It was World Series time. We had just had dinner, and the telephone in the apartment rang. And because we were underground, no one had that number. That phone had basically never run in about 6 months that we had lived there. And Jeff picked it up, and it was an FBI agent, and he said, we have the building surrounded. We have sharpshooters on the rooftops. And in a few seconds, the FBI is knocking on your door. So Jeff turned to Eleanor and said, we're busted.
Eleanor is your mom.
Eleanor's my mom. And then next thing I knew, the door was banging on the door, and then about 20 fully armored SWAT, FBI and police officers with M16s and shotguns stormed through the house. They took Jeff out into the hallway and made him crawl down the hallway. And what I remember is that there was a moment in all this sort of craziness when people had forgot about me, and I went down to my little bedroom at the end of the hall, and I was sort of looking through my belongings to see if I could find some way to help out. And I just had this feeling of, I had like a cowboy hat. I had some stuffed animals. I had a little pair of child's, safety scissors. And so it just, I remember feeling helpless. And I went back out and just stood with Jeff in the hallway. And, I had no idea what was happening. I had no idea that our family was different. I mean, I knew that we had had different names, but I had never really questioned it. And so this book is sort of about exploring how that came about.
What do you mean you had different names?
Well, we had, they were changing their aliases, and I would change my names. They were always similar. I was Timmy. I was TT. So, they would say, listen, Timmy, these people know you by this name. These people know you by this other name. These people know all your names. And, I just was like, whatever, I mean, if it had gone on a few more years, I was four, so I just sort of didn't question it. And I was amazed, talking to people during the research.
And at the moment that they were taken into custody, what happened to you?
They convinced the FBI to let a parent of one of my friends from daycare drive into the Bronx to pick me up. So I ended up spending that night with them, so people I knew. And then Eleanor was only in jail overnight, and Jeff was actually only in jail for a few weeks.
Jeff Jones, how did they find you?
We don't know how they found us. I mean, the point in time in which this took place was 3 days after the robbery of the Brinks truck in Nyack, New York, in October of 1981. And there was a massive FBI presence that had come into the New York City area immediately after that. Somehow or other, we were found, but we still don't know how it happened.
When they told you they were going to get you that night, what did you say about who was inside?
Well, on the phone, when the FBI agent called, I told him I wanted to say two things to him. One, I said, you have your bust, and we do not intend to resist the arrest. And the other thing I told him was that we had a child in the apartment, and that I appreciated his call. I mean, it's important from our family story at that particular moment in history, we had already been in negotiations through a lawyer to turn ourselves in. Our 11 years underground, we're going to come to an end at some point. It just happened to end that way at that time.
Why did you go underground?
Well, we went underground in 1970 at the height of the anti-war movement, at the height of trying to build support for the black liberation struggle. And we felt that there needed to be some level of resistance from the white movement in this country in support of people who were fighting back against the government policy in Vietnam, the racist policy of the government. And to this day, lots of us, including me, still think it was the right thing to try to do. We might have done it differently, and we certainly made some mistakes, but that's what we were trying to do. Of course, I'm sorry I put Ty in jeopardy as a result of that, but I think when he did his book, he found out that that was, had happened before in our family.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yes. Specifically about that, because I'm familiar with much of the history of the weathermen in SDS, since we were together in SDS before the weathermen developed. But I was most fascinated by the history of your family and how you began to uncover that history yourself, Ty. Can you talk about that process of discovery?
Sure. I think the book has two things. I mean, first of all, I think it's really the first examination of the 60s from the next generation in sort of a historical way, since I went at it as sort of a reporter. But the other difference is that I go back another generation to the 30s, and I show how those movements... Jeff's father was a pacifist and a Quaker, and he was a conscientious objector during World War II. And Eleanor's mother and father were Jewish Communist Party members from Brooklyn. So they're very different types of protests, but it just showed that the 60s didn't just happen. There was some strains were leading up to them. And so, all of that, I didn't know any of that story before I started.
You write about your mother's parents, Arthur and Annie Stein. Can you talk about them, Annie Stein and then Arthur and the House Un-American Activities Committee?
Sure. For me, they're sort of the real heroes of the story. Annie was... She fought for integration her whole life. That was her main issue. And they were Communist Party members in the 30s. And then they worked with Roosevelt in Washington. And by the 1950s, it actually was illegal to be a member of the Communist Party and also a government worker. So they went underground in Washington. So there's actually two different undergrounds in the book. And Artie, my grandfather, went before the HUAC committee twice, took the fifth both times. And that really was sort of the rite of passage of his time. And that stuff's all in there.
When you say took the fifth, what were they asking him about?
Well, they really didn't have anything. The way it worked is they were just fed names by these informers, and the system was really just designed to just get more names and just keep the tribunals running. So people who had known him in the 30s, who had sort of been pressured and given names, gave his name. So they really were just sort of putting him through the ringer. I mean, I don't think they expected any information from him.
He lost his job?
Well, yeah, for the last, about 10 years of his life, he just could not keep a steady job. He'd worked there for a few months, and then the FBI would come and tell the boss who he was, and he would get fired. And he actually died very young of a heart attack at 53.
And, Jeff, in terms of their experiences, how did they shape your political development and Eleanor's as well?
Well, it was a real honor for me to get to know Eleanor's mother, Annie. I didn't know Arthur, her father. Annie was a great leader of the desegregation movement. She fought against racism in the New York City Public School Department. And she was a very consistent person. It was great to work with her. On my side of the family, my father and mother were Quaker pacifists. And my father refused to participate in World War II. So that's what I grew up with in the Southern California Quaker culture, with a group of families where the men had gone to either jail or CPS camps rather than violate their religious beliefs of pacifism.
It's interesting to hear, Ty, you talk about the FBI going after your grandfather, your mother's father, going to his place of work, and then he would lose his job. In your case, Jeff, and you write about this, Ty, in A Radical Line, when you went underground, your father worked for Disney, and the FBI would go after him to go to the Disney studios to make it clear who he was and who his son was.
Exactly. He would the Disney Corporation, and it was a very mainstream conservative organization, and so the FBI would make a point of showing up during work hours to just put extra pressure on my father so that he would have to... sort of deal with them in the presence of his coworkers and his bosses.
He didn't agree with what you did.
He didn't agree with the violent part of what we did as a pacifist. And for me, that was a dramatic moment in my life where I went from being a pacifist to understanding that there might actually be a need to take some action that involved violence. That's sort of the dramatic juncture in our relationship. So he did not agree, and at one point he told me that he hoped that if we did use violence and that if anyone was injured or hurt, that it would be us rather than anyone else. else.
What did you do?
Well, I don't talk about what I did, but I would like to point out that the weather underground is known mainly for bombings. It was much more than that. It was a resistance network, something that a theme that I think this country will be talking about a lot more in the next 4 years. But in 1969 into 1970, in this country, there were an average of 2 bombings a day that were organized and carried out by somebody in resistance to the Vietnam War. We've long since forgotten that we lived in a country where that kind of stuff was going on.
Ty, do you consider your father a terrorist?
I don't think he would consider himself a terrorist, but I think that, back then they called it a guerrilla. But it's the same tactics. I think you have to admit it's the same tactics of people with less power fighting against people with more power. But I think that the distinction between, it's much easier to build a bomb that will hurt someone than to build a bomb that won't hurt anyone. So they made a real effort to not hurt anybody. In all their bombings, no one was ever hurt but themselves. So I think that's an important distinction.
And in terms of then the impact after your parents' arrest, in terms of your political development, how did your thinking evolve then over the years as you were growing up?
Well, they got off to such a bad start as parents that they definitely felt like they had to make up for it. And so, I and lots of kids from that same, history grew up together in a very safe, extended family. And, what's amazing to me is that none of us grew up to be young Republicans. On the one hand, it's hard to rebel against your parents if your parents are, symbols of rebellion themselves. But, for the most part, they raised us to be critical and to think for ourselves.
And what about the investigation into what your parents were involved with? Can you talk about what surprised you in this book and what you were willing to write about and what you were not willing to write about?
Sure. I never wanted to get my parents thrown in jail. So there were some things I might have asked just for my reporter's integrity, but I did not want to know.
Like?
Well, just who did what, when, just the details that no one knows and hopefully no one will ever know. For me, the strangest thing was imagining my parents doing the things that they were famous for doing in those days. They're so parental. They're so mild and mellow now. And it just shows how uncomfortable they were back then, the effort it took to be violent and to be crazy.
Like what?
Well, Jeff is famous for jumping up on stages and shoving speakers out of the way to grab the microphone and taking over meetings. And, if you know him now, you just couldn't imagine that kind of behavior. And the whole violence, the whole stance of violence, it was just so unnatural for this group of middle-class white Americans.
And Jeff, after the arrest, what were the charges eventually lodged against you? And did you have to serve any time? Could you give us some details on that as well?
Sure. The main charge that I had was an explosives possession charge from New Jersey, where I had, as Ty gleefully describes in the book, made a terrible mistake and was growing marijuana on a fire escape when I was still a fugitive, for which a fire inspector found the plants, came to the apartment, we had to run for it, and I picked up some extra charges that no one else had. But those were dealt with in New Jersey, and then I also had some charges stemming from the Days of Rage, so-called Days of Rage demonstrations in Chicago in 1969. I was very fortunate, proposed to the judge in New Jersey that society would be better served if I was to do an alternative to incarceration program, voluntary community service. I volunteered in an emergency room in Harlem for 6 months and also worked for free at the daycare center where Ty had been going at the time we were arrested. So then we just continued on with our new names at the daycare center.
Ty, we just have 30 seconds. I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, I think the last word is that people look at the Weather Underground and say, what did they accomplish? And obviously the answer is not much, but what they showed is that there's a point in which comfortable white Americans are willing to throw it over and take to the streets. And when I started this project, it was hard to imagine that point, but now 2 years later, I think we're sort of headed down that road. And 5 years from now, who knows? I mean, we already had 500,000 people in the street of New York during the Republican convention, and that's more than ever was during the 60s.
Ty and Jeff Jones, I want to thank you for being with us. Ty Jones' book is called A Radical Line, From the Labor Movement to the Weather Underground, One Family Century of Conscience. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. I'll see people in Austin for the 50th anniversary of the Texas Observer tomorrow on December 7th. I'll be with Richard Clark at the New York Ethical Culture Society. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.